ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, a traitor in the ranks, Australia's spy boss, says a former politician has sold our secrets to a foreign regime. So who is it? Also, Australia signs a new maritime agreement with the Philippines as tensions escalate in the South China Sea. And it's the last day of an extreme and forecast-defying summer. What's behind the weird weather?
Well, I think the summer has been quite unusual. We've had heavy rainfall along the east coast. Meanwhile, over in the west, it's tended to be really dry and very hot.
Thanks for your company. Who is the traitor? That question has gripped Australia's political circles today after the Director General of the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation, ASIO, revealed a former Australian politician was recruited by foreign agents and, quote, sold out our country to advance the interests of the foreign regime. Mike Burgess didn't name the person nor specify which parliament the politician sat in. But many former and serving MPs want the offender named so their reputations aren't damaged. This report from Samantha Donovan.
I want to know who the traitor is.
The former federal treasurer, Joe Hockey, is just one of the ex-politicians stunned by this revelation from Mike Burgess, the Director General of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO.
This politician sold out their country, party, former colleagues to advance the interests of a foreign regime. At one point, the former politician even proposed bringing a Prime Minister's family member into the spy's orbit. Fortunately, that plot did not go ahead, but others did.
Mr. Burgess revealed the case in his annual threat assessment delivered in Canberra last night. He told the audience threats to what he called our way of life have surpassed terrorism as ASIO's principal security concern. But he's confident the former politician is no longer a security risk.
Personally, I don't think they'll be stupid enough to repeat what they've done in the past. Now we're in a much better place with foreign interference laws.
Joe Hockey is adamant the ASIO boss should name the former politician he's referring to.
Absolutely. It besmirches everyone that has served their nation in the parliament. Did we work with them in the parliament? Did they ever approach us about an issue? What did we discuss with them? What did they do with that information? It's not good enough to be in the hold of the intelligence agencies. They need to let everyone know who worked with a foreign country against the interests of my country.
The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, has told Sydney radio station 2GB ASIO hasn't told him who the former politician is.
I think if you're putting that detail out there, as Mr. Burgess has done, then I think it's incumbent to either give a little bit more criteria or a little bit more of a hint as to who the person might be, because I think it is unfair on a lot of former MPs who are patriotic, as 99.9% on both sides are. Mm. And if there's one that they've identified who's not, then frankly, that person should be outed and shamed.
Labor's Richard Marles is the Minister for Defence.
Again, I think there's a whole range of reasons why individuals would not be named and that detail is not out there. So I respect the decision that ASIO have made in relation to this. Again, I think what we take from this is just the threat that exists and the importance for all of us who are involved in what we do, but not just politicians, as I say, everyone involved in public administration.
Dr. Bates Gill is an executive director at the Asia Society. He believes the ASIO Director General, Mike Burgess, made this shock announcement for a reason.
I suspect that there are continuing concerns about the activities of this Foreign Intelligence Service and probably many others. And it is his view that a warning needs to be made more loudly and clearly, not only for targets of those intelligence services, such as politicians and thought leaders in Australia, but for the wider public as well.
Do you infer from what he said that the foreign agents he referred to were from China?
Well, we can't know for certain, but we do know that Chinese intelligence services, as well as others, like those of the Russians and others, have been active in Australia for many, many years. but I think most of us assume that we're talking about China.
Does this sort of public statement or revelation have any impact on foreign operatives of a country like China? Do they take any notice?
Well, of course, they would. According to Mr. Burgess, individuals working for that Foreign Intelligence Service have been identified. That's got to send off some concerns and red flags within foreign intelligence services that their cover may well have been lifted and are probably interpreting themselves why it was that Mr. Burgess chose now to make these revelations.
Do you think Mr. Burgess should name the person he's referring to?
I think he's going to come under a lot of political pressure. They would have to be very, very sure, of course, of the allegations. They would want to be very, very sure that revealing the identity of the individual would not in some other way harm the ongoing investigation or reveal counterintelligence methods of Australia and partners. I think we can entrust the intelligence services to continue to do a good job, but to be aware, and this may well be what Mr. Burgess's overall point is, to increase the awareness, particularly among those individuals who are likely to be targets of foreign intelligence operations.
That's Dr. Bates Gill from the Asia Society, who is speaking to our reporter Samantha Donovan. Well, Senator Simon Birmingham is the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs. He's also a member of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. He joined me earlier. Senator Birmingham, thanks for being with us. You want the Home Affairs Minister to release more information about this individual, if not name them. Why should she do that when the ASIO boss clearly thought that that wasn't a good idea?
Well, the ASIO Director General does a very important job in terms of ensuring that all Australians understand the security risks and challenges our country faces. And for a number of years now, he has highlighted foreign interference and espionage as being high amongst those risks. And he's certainly been briefing members of parliament, ministers for many years about how to be alert to those risks and how to make sure that if they present themselves, you address them very, very quickly and promptly and in the appropriate ways. Now, he's right to highlight those risks. What he did last night is also appropriate in that sense. But he has created a question mark that hangs over all former members of parliament. And that question mark is an unfair one for essentially all but potentially one of them who was the subject of the remarks that were made. The Minister for Home Affairs has the potential in the parliament to at least provide more information, more context, to provide as much information as possible. And ideally, that would include the identity of the individual.
You're not suggesting that Mike Burgess erred, are you?
I'm not suggesting that he erred. He has a job to do, and that job in terms of the awareness of the security threats we face as a nation is an important one, and giving contextual examples of it is a valuable part of the way in which he can raise that awareness. But the example does beg many questions. The way in which it's presented indicates that were somebody to behave this way today, they may well be breaching criminal laws that have been put in place to further protect Australia. Mm. The fact that it's a couple of years old means that they have potentially avoided those prosecutions, but it doesn't
mean... How does that make you feel, knowing that a former politician who, according to Mike Burgess, sold out our country can't actually be charged?
Well, that's just it. These are very serious, very grave allegations. And, of course, they are being made by the head of our security agency, who has taken them right through, including the confronting of the individual involved, who it appears, based on the statements that he's confident they wouldn't be so silly to do it again, that they acknowledge the errors of their ways. Mm. Now, it could be solved by the individual identifying themselves, but the government has, of course, the ability on the floor of the parliament to provide further information in ways that is not necessarily available to Mr. Burgess.
In your understanding, what country is largely responsible for this kind of traditional, if I can call it that, espionage threat?
Well, there are lots of different types of threats that we face in the traditional way, as you put it, as well as in the cyber domain. There is little doubt that China has engaged increasingly in conduct that seeks to gather information and build relationships to gather that information and potentially to undertake influence. Just as we've seen in the cyber domain, increased threats, including critically coming from Russia, both state and non-state actors, and the identification that has been made of both of those countries in a number of different attacks and instances over recent years.
On another matter, the Philippines president addressed Parliament today, and Australia signed a new agreement to deepen maritime cooperation with the Philippines. How important are these closer ties between Manila and Canberra in the pushback against China's growing aggression in the region?
Regional cooperation is essential. The Philippines are a very strong advocate for adherence to the international laws of the sea. And indeed, they have ensured that their rights as a nation have been upheld through the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And that's critical because those rights have been contested and challenged as China has sought to expand its sphere of influence across the South China Sea. That is why Australia's position in calling for the UNCLOS Convention, the Law of the Sea, to be upheld, for its findings, including in relation to the Philippines, to be respected, are important positions that we take, and the support that we continue to provide to the Philippines and other nations of the region for freedom of navigation and movement is essential because this is our largest trade route and critical in terms of our ongoing economic well-being and our sovereignty to be able to engage ourselves and all of the other nations who rely on that trade route.
Senator Simon Birmingham, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, David. My pleasure.
And Senator Birmingham is the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs. PM requested an interview with the Minister for Home Affairs, but she was unavailable. Australia and the Philippines, as you just heard there, have signed a new agreement to deepen maritime cooperation. As tensions between Beijing and Manila continue to escalate in the South China Sea, details of the Memorandum of Understanding remain unclear, but in this rare speech to Federal Parliament in Canberra, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. vowed his country will not yield an inch of territory to China. Anna Pikett reports.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the Republic of the Philippines.
On behalf of the Australian Government and indeed the Australian people, it is my very great pleasure to welcome you to our nation's Parliament.
Ferdinand Marcos Jr. addressed Parliament in Canberra today, the President declaring the Philippines is on the front line against actions that undermine regional peace. He reaffirmed his strong stance against Beijing's activities in the South China Sea, where it's been deploying Coast Guard ships, its navy and an informal militia of fishing boats to try and force the Philippines out. All this despite international rulings that China has no right to the territories.
The challenges that we face may be formidable, but equally formidable is our resolve. The protection of the South China Sea as a vital, critical global artery is crucial to the preservation of regional peace and of global peace.
At no point did President Marcos name China in his speech, but when he referenced coercive behaviour and challenges to the rule of law on the sea, it was clear who he was talking about. In November last year, Australia and the Philippines held joint military drills in the South China Sea, a sign of Manila's efforts to build deeper links with Western nations. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese today spoke of those ties.
We are both island nations. We are both trading nations. And for both of us, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea is not an abstract notion or a theoretical question. Freedom of navigation is fundamental to our sovereignty, our prosperity, our security, and our territorial integrity.
Jay Buttonbacol is a professor with the University of the Philippines College of Law. He says Canberra and Manila have a lot to gain by working together.
It is a common interest of both Australia and the Philippines. He actually expressed the common viewpoint between the two countries about the importance of the region to ensure that the status quo that international law has established since the end of the Second World War remains in place and is not changed by other parties.
Today, President Marcos and Prime Minister Albanese signed a memorandum of understanding to strengthen cooperation.
We are called upon once again to join forces together with our partners in the face of threats to the rule of law, to stability and to peace. For the Philippines, Australia plays a crucial role as one of only two partners with which the Philippines has a visiting forces agreement.
Professor Bitambakul says more joint military exercises could be on the cards in the near future.
Given that the two countries already have a status of forces agreement, I would think that probably within the year, they will at the very least hold some more joint exercises, as well as announce further progress on their military cooperation.
Opposition leader Peter Dutton also heaped praise on Mr. Marcos, saying that the Philippines had been bullied by autocrats and belligerent regimes. But not everyone was happy to see the Filipino leader. Some Green senators boycotted his special address, while Senator Janet Rice was asked to leave the chamber after holding up a sign to protest human rights abuses in the Philippines. Today's address comes ahead of a special ASEAN summit in Melbourne next weekend, which Prime Minister Albanese says will commemorate 50 years of Australia's partnership with the regional bloc.
There will be four themes of the conference. The overall summit theme is a partnership for the future. Those four themes are maritime cooperation, trade and investment, climate and energy, and emerging leaders.
It's hoped that hosting the event will give Australia an opportunity to build not just strategic, but also business links with Southeast Asia.
Anna Pikett there. You're listening to PM with me, David Lipson, and don't forget, all our programs can be heard either live or later via the ABC Listen app. With an election looming in Tasmania, the state's Liberal government has pledged to open up 40,000 hectares of native forest to logging in areas conservationists have fought to protect. The government argues growing demand for sustainably produced wood products means it is the right time now, but one expert argues the move doesn't make sense environmentally or economically. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Just over 10 years ago, there were high hopes that Tasmania's decades-long forest wars might be over.
The Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, has spent the weekend in Hobart negotiating a deal designed to end the conflict between loggers and conservationists over Tasmania's forests.
Ultimately, a peace deal saw almost 400,000 hectares of land placed into reserves, much of it in areas conservationists argue is high-value forest. The Liberals tore up that agreement in 2014, instead setting the land aside as a so-called wood bank that could be logged in the future. Tasmanian Liberal Resources spokesman Felix Ellis says the time to start accessing it has arrived.
There is no doubt that in this century, a carbon-constrained century, the world needs more forestry, not less, and it needs to come from countries that manage their forests well and regrow them, just as we do here in Tasmania.
The Liberal Party is pledging to open up 40,000 hectares to native forest logging if it's re-elected next month. But Mr. Ellis denies the policy would see a return to the forest wars.
No, I think the forest wars are in the past. I think people now realise that forestry is one of the most sustainable industries there is. It's the only way to produce renewable carbon-capturing building products to provide a plastic-free future.
Disputes have played out in the forests over the past decade. Derry was arrested earlier today in the Styx Valley in southern Tasmania.
I attached myself to a piece of logging machinery and basically stayed there until the police came and cut me off it.
Derry was trying to protect giant eucalyptus regnans, the tallest flowering tree in the world.
If people think about big trees, right, their minds probably go straight to the Californian redwoods, maybe the sequoias over in California. And guess what? We've got trees that are only a couple of metres shorter.
Jenny Weber is a campaign manager with the Bob Brown Foundation. She's worried the land in question includes high-value forests conservationists wanted permanently protected.
This was exactly what I predicted way back when I was involved in this process, where I was on the outside of the negotiations saying we are not going to get forests protected up front. The industry is going to get all their money up front, and here we are.
Jenny Weber wants to know which timber companies would look to source products from the area. That's something Liberal Resources spokesman Felix Ellis wouldn't say.
I'm not going to provide green activists with a hit list of people to go after.
Those in the logging industry are still considering the idea. Matthew Terenius is the spokesman for the Tasmanian Sawmillers Association.
Look, I really think we need to see more detail around what is actually on the land, whether it is worthwhile investigating, and we'd really need to see more of an assessment around that. I think the industry knows that a lot of that land is not really going to be suitable for harvesting.
I think it's madness. Absolute madness.
Professor David Lindenmeyer is a forest ecologist with the Australian National University.
There is now overwhelming evidence from across Australia that native forest logging makes forests more flammable, and it makes them more flammable for decades ahead. So not only is the Tasmanian government going to engage in a loss-making industry that employs next to nobody, it's going to embark on activities that increase the flammability of forests.
The move would be in contrast to other states' approaches. Western Australia and Victoria have been moving away from native forest logging.
Tasmania is clearly out of step with the rest of the country, and so this is a really ill-informed set of policies. It's not based on evidence, it's not based on science, and it's actually not based on good economics.
Tasmania's Labor Party has accused the Liberals of failing to consult with the industry before releasing their policy.
Alexandra Humphreys there. There are renewed warnings of dark clouds hanging over the Australian economy. While a recession is no certainty, the Treasurer appears to be laying the groundwork for some pretty ordinary official economic growth figures due for release next week. While today's profit announcement from Harvey Norman and the release of Bureau of Statistics retail sales figures highlight how fragile household budgets have become. So is it all enough to convince the Reserve Bank to lower interest rates sooner rather than later? David Taylor takes a look.
The former boss of upmarket department store, David Jones, says sales in one particular product are up. And that tells you something about the economy.
Now, when we're seeing a downturn in sales, because I've been in this game for a little longer than I'd like to admit, we see that women particularly will go and actually spend money on a new lipstick to update their look versus buying a new dress. And that's what we're seeing. You're seeing those high levels of compromise in their shopping.
Paul Zara, who now runs the Australian Retailers Association, also says more Australians are spending money on fun to help lift their spirits.
What we did see an increase in, which was interesting, is a category that the ABS call as other, and that was in recreational sporting goods. So people were trying to sort of uplift their spirits by spending more time outdoors, including cafes and restaurants. They were up at 2.5%.
Bureau of Statistics data today show retail sales rose a seasonally adjusted 1.1% in January, slightly lower than expected. And the ABS made a point of noting that if you look over several months of data, retail sales are dead flat. And today, retailer Harvey Norman posted a 45% drop in its profit to $200 million.
David, it's across the board. So when you look at cost increases, it's across everything. Every household is under so much pressure, whether that's insurance, utilities, food. And of course, when they've paid all these things, this is why what we're seeing now, they're not updating their wardrobes. You know, they're not spending money on their homes.
With the cost of living still causing household stress, Treasurer Jim Chalmers is delivering a sobering message ahead of next week's December quarter economic growth, or GDP, figures.
We understand that the inevitable consequence of higher interest rates and persistent inflation and global uncertainty means that we are expecting quite weak growth in our economy. Inflation's still our major concern, but at some stage, the balance of risks in our economy and in the global economy is going to shift from inflation to growth.
The UK and Japan have both slipped into recession, counted as two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. New Zealand will know if it's in recession next month with the release of the December quarter economic growth figures after the economy contracted in the September quarter. As for the Australian economy, well, the NAB's chief economist, Alan Oster, isn't ruling out a recession.
It's not silly. Because, you know, if we're talking about plus 0.2 for this quarter's growth, and we're talking the same sort of numbers in the next quarter, March and June, you don't need very much to go wrong to suddenly produce a couple of negative quarters. But I'd be more inclined to say my definition of recession is when unemployment's gone up 1% within a year. And hopefully we won't get there.
ANZ senior economist Adelaide Timbrell's also watching the unemployment rate closely.
If you think about a recession in terms of a
really rapid rise in the unemployment rate. That's something that could be arguably a possibility over this coming cycle, depending on the definition.
While Alan Oster and Adelaide Timbrell agree, households will be sweating on the Stage 3 tax cuts and Reserve Bank interest rate cuts before the end of the year.
It does, though, show us that 2024 is very likely to be the year that we see rates starting to come down. And the Stage 3 tax cuts, which are, in essence, equivalent to around 2 rate cuts, will help as well.
Official economic growth figures are released next Wednesday, while the Reserve Bank makes its next interest rates decision on March 19.
David Taylor there. Well, this is the last day of summer, and around the country there has been some pretty surprising weather, you could say, from torrential rain on the east coast to extreme temperatures in the west. The higher than average rainfall in the east is particularly odd and upended long-range forecasts for a hot, dry summer. Climatologists say higher than average ocean temperatures are behind the unexpected rains. Here's John Daly.
It's a perfect day for one last summer swim at Cottesloe Beach in Perth. The Bureau of Meteorology says Perth has had 7 days above 40 degrees in February, smashing the previous record of 4 days. Locals have mixed reviews about the summer that was.
Yeah, summer's been great. The weather's been unreal and the swell's been up, but hasn't really been pumping enough. So, yeah.
I take it you're a surfer?
Yeah, yeah.
Very hot compared to UK.
How long have you been here?
About 2.5 weeks. So coming from like -3 to, it was, I think it was about 38, 40. It was very, very hot.
Did you know what to do?
Not a clue. I just drunk lots of water and ice cream.
I'm really pleased that summer's pretty much over. But I found it really hot. Not a fan. I'm actually from a rather cold area over in the Snowy Mountains, so I haven't acclimatised to Perth, even though I've been here a while. So I'm looking forward to autumn and winter.
Further to the north in WA, temperatures reached close to 50 degrees this month in parts of the Gascoyne and the Midwest, some of the hottest temperatures recorded in Australia. Now, it's a stark difference to the torrential rain in other parts of the country like Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. The regional Victorian town of Rochester flooded in January. Luckily, it wasn't as bad as the devastating 2022 floods, but caravan park owner Mick Haysman says it's put people on alert this summer.
Well, it puts everyone on edge. Everyone's still on edge from the floods of 2022, that's for sure, like October. So it's only been 18 months. Any time it rains in Rochi now, people get very, very nervous. So.
Has all this rain caught people off guard a little bit?
Oh, I think it probably would. I mean, a lot of people go on those long-range predictions, and it's just very unpredictable at the minute, the rainfall, that's for sure. The weather's very inconsistent and very humid year overall.
Before this summer began, the long-range outlook suggested the eastern states were in for a season of hot and dry conditions because of the El Niño event in the Pacific Ocean. But that wasn't the case. Australian National University climatologist Jeanette Lindsay says this summer has been a bit weird.
Well, I think the summer has been quite unusual. We've had cyclone-related flooding in Queensland. We've had other heavy rainfall along the east coast and the eastern inland, Victoria as well. Meanwhile, over in the west, in WA, it's tended to be really dry and very hot.
The Observatory Hill weather station in Sydney collected 98 millimetres of rain in December and 129 millimetres of rain in January. Compare that to the average of 74 millimetres and 80 millimetres respectively. The weather station at Melbourne's Olympic Park caught 71 millimetres of rain in December and 108 millimetres of rain in January, and the average is 51 millimetres and 40 millimetres for those months. Professor Jeanette Lindsay says really high ocean temperatures are the culprit.
Down the Australian east coast, it's actually been really warm in terms of ocean temperatures. And I'm not just talking right on the coast. I'm talking, you know, hundreds of kilometres out to sea. And we're looking at temperatures between 1 and 3 degrees above average. So the oceans of the globe have been warmer than any other time in the previous record now for a bit. And so that has contributed to having a lot more warm, moist air.
Is climate change making these longer range forecasts, you know, predictions of these drivers and what effect they'll have on the weather harder to map, harder to measure?
This is a really interesting question. We don't really have a clear answer to that at this point.
The Bureau of Meteorology is forecasting below median rainfall from March to May for much of northern, eastern and southwestern Australia.
John Daly there. Well, that's the program for today. Thanks for joining me on PM. I'm David Lipson. The team will be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. She had a grand ambition to knock off Donald Trump and become the Republican Party's choice to run in November's US election. But Nikki Haley couldn't do it, and it's almost certain now that Trump will run against Joe Biden. So why has she held on? Why doesn't she just give up before almost certain defeat at so-called Super Tuesday next week? Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.